Blog Talk Radio.
To be the man, you gotta beat the man.
You wanna find out how good you are? You're looking at the American shit. Let's go hook him up!
I just whipped your ass.
You take it all away.
I'm gonna dog you until I wear your Texas ass out.
The game is ours to play.
And hell, I might even get on top of my wife tonight.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Over the Top Radio. I am your host, Ed, in San Antonio, and I may or may not be joined by my co-host tonight. Craig has the night off because they're having some kind of family thing or some kind of dinner thing going on. And just for everyone's information, no, Craig has not quit Over the Top Radio. He's just serving 1 week of wellness violations. And he will be back next week. Katrera, on the other hand, may or may not be calling in because, unfortunately and sadly, he had to put his dog down today. And I know how that feels. Not too long ago, about a year ago, I had to put my cat of almost 19 years down. And that just really sucks. So I don't blame him if he doesn't call in. Luckily, tonight we do have a guest, so it won't just be me rambling on for an hour to 90 minutes. I'm good at talking, but I'm not good at doing a one-man show. I don't know how, Mike Kaufman does his. I mean, I got to give him credit for being able to just go on by himself for such a long time. And that's not really my thing. My thing's just to interject and be an asshole. But luckily, we do have a very good guest, a guest that I'm very familiar with because when I first started watching wrestling, he was just starting out in the business. He's been in the business for a very long time, over 30 years, and he's done a lot of things, including train the most over-professional wrestler in the business today in Daniel Bryan, along with a lot of other guys like Spanky and Paul London. And the late Lance Cade, and quite a few others. He still trains people. And I don't see Katrera, so I'm not positive if he's going to call in. I'm going to go ahead and play the theme song again and then call our guest. Hopefully it won't take too long for me to get back. So everyone... Just bear with me, and we'll get the interview going as soon as possible.
To be the man, you gotta beat the man.
You wanna find out how good you are? You're looking at the American shit. Let's go hook him up.
I just whipped your ass.
It's time. You take it all away.
I'm gonna dog
beg you until I wear your Texas ass out.
And hell, I might even get on top of my wife tonight.
Slight problem. He didn't pick up, and I went to voicemail right away. So, fortunately, when I disconnected the second call, it totally hanged me up on both things, so I had to recall in. So, just bear with me on this. I will have him on very soon. I'm just gonna have to retry again. So, I'll go ahead and play a little longer drop just in case something happens again.
Change your heart, it seems like, you know. I know this is blood is a little deeper than water and everything, and Ken is run kind of deep and all, but, you know, it was a time when you didn't go for, you know, rough tactics like that, and just because he's your kin, you can't uphold what he's doing.
What about that?
I don't understand him being a great wrestler.
You know, I've had some time to think. And you ought to know probably as well as anybody the things that have happened to me in my life in the past,
what,
year, 6 months, whatever it is. And I think you know that I've done what I could do. But frankly, I finally realized maybe it doesn't do any good. Maybe it's a waste of time. I look at that kid, and you're right. I see an Anderson. I see what it can be. I don't see what somebody else wants me to make it. I see what it can be for me. I can see what it might do for that kid. And if you really stop and think about it, Bolt, if you give it some time and reflect on it, you're looking at me right now, I feel like I'm going back in time. Well, maybe that's what we ought to do. Maybe that's what we got to do. Maybe that's what it has to be. Maybe it's got to go back in time. Because if I look at it honestly, I look at you, and I look at Tommy Rich, and I look at Dusty Rhodes, I look at this Magnum TA, and I realize, all of a sudden, like a light, when I see this kid, all of a sudden I realize, you know what, Ole, you've been a kind of a dummy. You know why? No, wait a minute, you know why? Because, Bolt, frankly, I've been carrying you, I've been carrying Tommy Rich, I've been carrying Dusty Rhodes, I've been carrying all of you. I've been carrying you. I can squat with 700 pounds and all of you together weigh a little bit more, and I'm just finally tired of it. You used to tell me how... don't shake your head.
The people told me. The people said, hey, look, there isn't anything changing. I mean, this is just the trinket before you, you know, this goes way back. Way, way back. I mean, are you going to be a liar?
No, I don't call it a liar. I don't call it a liar. I realize I just wake up. No, wait a minute. Let me say something. They talk about, get that camera, and you say you look in a person's eyes, and you can tell whether they're giving you any garbage, BSing you, so they call it.
Yeah.
You take a look, and you're going to see in my eyes, you're going to see the truth. I'm going to just tell you right now, oh, don't worry, I'm not going to touch you, not yet. I'm going to tell you this. Today is a free day. Today is a day that you and I look at each other and I admit, nice guy that you were, whatever. But I help you, you can't deny it. The days are over, I'm leaving. Next time I see you, I would suggest maybe you watch out.
Okay, guys, I had a little more trouble, but I actually just talked to Rudy on the other line. He will be calling into the number here in just a minute. So he is going to make the show. Don't worry about that. We're just having a little trouble, technical difficulties, you know, live show, no co-host. So once again, I'll blame Craig for this, and we'll say it's Craig's fault. So... hopefully he'll call in pretty soon here. And once again, he started here in San Antonio. He lives here in San Antonio, and he started with Southwest Championship Wrestling, which is actually the third wrestling that I ever watched, because I did see Georgia first. I did see WWF, and then I found Southwest. And I got to watch a lot of great guys in the prime. I mean, I got to see Waffle McDaniel. I mean, he was already older, but he was still fantastic. And I got to see a very young Tully Blanchard and a young Gino Hernandez at the Dynamic Duel, and they were great. You know, so the Sheep Herders had a good run here in San Antonio. And, you know, and, excuse me. Here he is. Let me introduce him. Everybody, welcome our guest, Rudy Boy Gonzalez. Rudy, how are you doing?
Hey, how are you doing?
Doing pretty good. For those that don't know, Rudy Boy Gonzalez, like I was saying a little earlier, he's been in the business for about 30 years, which is a very long time. So my first question to you, Rudy, is how is your health?
I'm fine. I mean, I'm beat up like anybody else would be, being around this long. But, I mean, I honestly, compared to the other guys, I guess, that have been around as long. I mean, I don't have bad knees. I don't have bad hips. I mean, my back is a little worn from, you know, from the bumps and stuff in the ring or whatever. And, you know, I'm not crippled, I guess you could say. I can still you know, do matches. I can still perform. I'm fine.
Well, that's good to hear, because there are a lot of guys who unfortunately are like in rough shape, you know, like even like a current wrestler like Rey Mysterio, he looks like he's hurting and he's going to be in bad shape in a few years. And I hope that's not the case. He's one of my favorites, but I worry about guys like him. What's your take on guys?
It's just the style that they do. You know, I mean, when I broke in, it wasn't the stuff that they're doing now, the hurricanranas and dives and all that. I mean, Chavo Guerrero did a flip off the top rope, off the top corner one time, and everybody thought that was like the coolest thing in the world. Mil Bosquez used to climb the top of the corner and do a splash. I mean, just do a dive like from the top corner onto somebody. Not a backflip, I mean, just a dive, you know. And that was the coolest finish in the world back then. We just had matches. We didn't try and kill ourselves to get our matches over. We went out and wrestled. You know, and if you go and see a wrestling match, like I saw a wrestling match on ESPN last night. It was Oklahoma and Iowa State or something like that, Indiana or something. And I see one of those kids do a backflip or a hurricanrana or, you know, dive out off the mat onto the bleachers. You know, and they just wrestled. And that's what we did. I mean, we took bumps like everything, you know, our guys do now, but everything had a meaning to it. Now a guy will do 50 flips and bumps and dives and whatever in the first 5 minutes of a match. And, you know, the fans are like, okay, now what are you going to do? You know? And that's not what it's about. So because of that, and guys like those people, you know, fans like to see that stuff on TV or whatever, but because of that, guys are getting beat up more, you know. I mean, the ring is only, most rings are a layer of, you know, steel pipes and then a layer of 2x12 boards and then a 1-inch padding. And that's it. That padding's 1 inch. It's there mainly for show. It doesn't really, protect you a whole lot. I mean, it's better than falling directly on the boards, but I mean, your body's still taking an impact, you know?
Yeah. Now, Rudy, you started in, I believe it was it 82 for Southwest Championship Wrestling?
I walked into the wrestling office January 2nd, 1982, and it was because I was taking my Christmas break off from college. I went to play junior college football, and I was back here for the Christmas break, and I couldn't afford, you know, going to the gym back then. You know, we didn't have, like, 50 Gold's gyms all over San Antonio like there is now. There was, like, a few gyms, and I just couldn't afford it. So my football coach, who was very good friends with Joe Blanchard, said, you're only going to be here for a few weeks. My friend's opening up a wrestling school. I'm not telling you, his exact words were, I'm not telling you to be a wrestler, but a lot of the guys that he has over there are former football players, which was like Ivan Putski and Bruiser Brody and Wong McDaniel. And Telly was a quarterback at Churchill High School here in San Antonio. And I recognized Telly's name. There was a guy who was a wrestler. His name was Leo Seitz, who was actually a football coach at one of the high schools. And he was very good friends with my football coach also. So I went, and I don't know, someone asked me the other day, well, what made you stay? I can't tell you exactly what it was that made me not go back to school, but I didn't go back to school. And, the Blanchards, Joe and Tully, allowed me to learn the business. I mean, that's what I told Mr. Blanchard. I decided I wanted to stick around. He knew what I was there for. And so when the 2 weeks were up and I was supposed to go back to school, instead I walked in the office and he asked me, what are you doing here? And I said, well, I want to talk to you about some stuff. And he said, well, sit down. And, he said, well, what can I help you with? And I said, well, I want to learn the wrestling business. And he just gave me this stare, like your dad would stare at you. And for like a lifetime, it felt like. It felt like an hour he was staring at me. He was like, don't you have a 2-year scholarship? I said, yeah, I do. Are you effing crazy? Do you know what you're giving up? Do you know what you're getting into? And he just laid into me for about, I don't know, it was probably about 5 minutes. He just, like, told me every horror story in the wrestling business. I was going to starve. I'd sleep in my car. I wouldn't have a relationship. I'd miss birthdays. I'd miss anniversaries. I would move around. I'd travel all the time. I would never have my feet firmly on the ground. You know, just stuff like everything he could think of to deter me from getting into this. And I didn't want to be a wrestler. That wasn't my intention. I didn't say I want to be a wrestler. I said I wanted to learn the wrestling business. And he goes, is that what you want? And I said, yeah, I want to learn this business. And he said, all right, well, this was a Monday morning, and Monday was TV. So he said, all right, go next door. There's a mop bucket in the corner. Fill it up with water. There's some pine saw. Start mopping. That was my first official job, wrestling. So January 2nd, 1982 is when I started, and then my first match was like April 16th of 1984.
Now you actually just posted about your first match, and that you actually, I guess you weren't prepared, and you had to borrow boots and trunks some of the guys.
During the course of my learning the business, I did the ring and, sold T-shirts and sold, put out flyers or whatever. But I also refereed, and a couple of guys, I guess they liked me, Manny would tell me, what are you doing tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock? Nothing. Meet me at the Junction. The place that we trained, that we did our TV show, is called Junction. It's on Blankwood Fulton, San Antonio. And meet me at the Junction at 9 o'clock in the morning. So I'd go there, and he'd get in the ring, and, had a bump. All right, do this. At the same time, I was training with a guy named Larry Lane in the evening. He was doing the actual wrestling, amateur wrestling type stuff. So the mornings I was training with Manny and Chavo, or this guy named Ali Bay the Turk, or this guy named Grenade Boyer.
Yeah, I remember. I remember Ali Bay. He was. I was actually a big fan of his. I thought he was awesome. He was like a little short, chubby guy that wrestled
surfboard. Yes, yes. The looks are deceiving though, because I was this football player kid, and I wasn't a bodybuilder type guy, but I was in decent shape. And he came in one day, and he was he was like, you wanna get in the ring, you know, some accent or whatever. And I was like, yeah, let me show you suplex. All right, sure. And he snatched one arm and he grabbed my shoulder or whatever and did whatever and then flipped me through the air and my suplex was shed. I mean, he gave me like 15 different suplexes. And then I found out later that he was like an alternate on the Turkey Olympic team or something. He was actually he was an actual shooter. I mean, he wasn't nobody to mess with. And here I am trying to this little, like you said, little short, heavyset guy. And I was like, I'm going to jack him up a little bit. They did meet that way, though. So my job was on Mondays to Monday night TV started at 8 o'clock, you know, sometimes a little later. But my job was to stand at this table, which was like about 3 feet or so from the ring, and to ring the bell. And that was my job. I'm like, do not leave this place. Do not leave that area. You're going to start the match. You're going to end the match. As soon as the referee says ring the bell, ring the bell. You know, and it was for TV. And so that's what I did. So, and I almost took my spot like about 10 till 8 or so, you know, 10 minutes before the match. I just, you know, I grabbed my hammer and I'd stand there. And every Monday night that place was packed. The summertime it was hot. The wintertime it was cold. But every Monday night we had 300 packed people in that place. So I'm standing there, and somebody no-showed. And so Al Perez, and I had trained with him a couple of times here and there, and he came in and he goes, hey, what size shoes you wear? And I was like, I wear 10 and a half. He goes, what size shorts you wear? So I wear medium. He goes, come on, let's go. So I'm like, well, what about, he'll put the hammer down, let's go, come on, we ain't got time. So, you know, he takes me to the back, and everybody's back there getting dressed, and Jonathan Boyd, who was the booker at that time, he asked me the same thing. What size shoes do you wear? I wear 10 and a half. What size shorts do you wear? I wear medium. He goes, anybody wear 10 and a half boots? And Eric Embry said, I got a pair. Hey, anybody wear medium trunks? And Bobby Fulton said, I got an extra pair, you know, and gave it to me and put them on. And I was like, whoa, what am I, you know, they don't have time to ask questions, just put your stuff on. And so I basically got thrown in the fire. I believe I was partners with a guy named Manuel Villalobos, and we wrestled against the New Zealand Sheepherder. That was my very first match.
Oh, that's tough. I can only imagine, because I remember that era, and the Sheepherders, it was a really bloody time in Southwest. Yeah,
it was, I mean, it was as, you know, I mean, without saying too much, it was as real as it can get. I mean, it was, like you said, it was blood everywhere. I mean, it was a crazy time. It was a good time, though. It was a good era. And, you know, I mean, they were, you know, the Sheepherders, Luke Williams and Butch Miller, they were tough dudes. But, you know, they taught me a lot. Manny was a tough guy. He taught me a lot. Al Perez, Eric Embry, Kent Timms. I mean, all these guys, they were, you know, they all helped me going along. And so after that match, I came to the back. And, I mean, I had no clue what I was doing. I mean, Emmanuel started the match off, and as soon as the guy, they got some other guy to ring the bell. As soon as he rang the bell, they just went to town. They just started beating his ass. I mean, and I'm like, oh, my God, that's my turn. And I heard somebody say, tag in your partner. And I'm like, Jesus Christ, here I come. So Emmanuel just tags me, and I jump in the ring. And Luke's running at me, and I hear someone say clothesline. And so I stuck my arm out, and I think I gave him a shitty-looking clothesline. And then the other guy comes, and I hear someone say, fire up. And I have no idea what the hell they're telling me. I learned how to do so. I just didn't learn the terminology I didn't know the terminology that well. So, and then they cut me. You know, I had my back on one of them. He cut me off, and then I heard him say, tag in your partner. So I tagged in Manuel again, and they pinned him. And so we lost the match, obviously. And so we go to the back. And, I mean, it was like a blink of an eye. The match lasted about eight minutes, I guess. But it was like a second. I mean, it was a second of my life that I have no idea where it went. And so back there, there was a monitor. The back's a monitor where you could see all the matches. So I go to the back, and, you know, everyone's, you know, talking and stuff. And so Jonathan Boyd says, "You did a good job, mate." He goes, "Those aren't your boots, though, right?" I said, "No." He said, "Those aren't your trunks. When can you get your own stuff?" And I was like, "I have no idea where to get. I don't know." And he said, "Eric, give him the address to this place called K&H, which made wrestling gear. To give him the address to K&H, give him Bill Ash's phone number. This guy Bill Ash lived in Arkansas. He was the bootmaker. And give Bill Ash's phone number. You know, as soon as you get your own stuff, let us know, and we'll put you to work." And that was it. So, and it's funny we're talking about this because I have an issue with a guy in my own, one of my own guys. It's funny. You know, I didn't have my own stuff, so I couldn't wrestle until I had my own stuff. Same thing with this guy. He doesn't have his own stuff, so, you know, he's kind of like in a bind right now. So what I did was, I mean, I went and cut some grasses and break some leaves and, you know, cleaned out some yards and stuff and did them. My neighbors, you know, where my parents lived, they had a construction company. It was called T&D Moravitz. I worked with them for a couple of days or whatever, and they paid me, and I had enough money. You know, back then, boots were like $150, just plain white patent leather boots, and trunks were like $40 or something. And they got, you know, they sent them out to you in 2 weeks or so. And as soon as I got them, I opened up the box and I had my stuff. Then my trunks came in, and the next day or something. So I hauled ass to the office. And, "Hey, you know, Jonathan Boyd, look what I got." And so he was like, "All right, mate. Well, let's see. I've already got next week booked. So on the, you know, 3 weeks from now or whatever, I have you in this town. And if things work out, I'll have you in this town." And I was booked. And that's how I got my illustrious career started.
Wow, that's actually pretty cool. I mean, it's just like, you know, you have. It seems like you had one shot and you actually pulled it off, even though, like you said, you weren't sure you knew what you were doing. And when you started
there was,
Southwest, Southwest had a lot of talent, actually, in the early 80s. Like you said, Manny Fernandez, Waffle McDaniel, Telly Blanchard, Gina Hernandez, Dick Slater, Carlos Colon, Al Perez, Chief Herders, just Ricky Morton was there with Tim Lucas, a lot of talent. What was it like, you know, since you mentioned you worked for Joe Blanchard, what was Telly like back in the days? Because, you know, you'll hear stories about when he was when he was wrestling that he was not the easiest guy to get along with. He since, like, changed his life around, you know, with the religion. But, you know, I've heard all the stories. What was he like back then? Because he was, you know, very early in his career at the time.
Joe?
Telly.
Are you talking about Telly?
Yeah, I'm talking about Telly.
Telly was Telly. He was, what you saw on TV was what you got in real life. I mean, he was... he was the hometown guy, and he was a stud quarterback at high school. He went to the best. He went to one of the top high schools in San Antonio. He played state champion. Telly was a stud, and in the very beginning, I tried to watch him and copy some of the stuff that he did. I mean, Telly was, you know, his dad owned the promotion, and things were good, so he had. You know, just like if your dad had a wrestling promotion and you know, you're put to work, you know, and, you know, you'd have a little bit of an attitude, you know, on you also. And I rubbed some of the guys the wrong way, you know, but the thing was that, how can I put it? Like some guys, they have the attitude, they talk the noise, but when you get them in the ring, they just, you know, it's a whole different deal. Telly could deliver. Telly was... In my opinion, knowing what I know now, Telly is one of the top heels ever, one of the top bad guys ever, if not the bad guy. I mean, he wasn't the biggest guy. He wasn't the bodybuilder type guy either, but he just knew how to piss people off. He knew how to get the good guy in the right spot, in the right positions. He knew Telly knew his way around the ring, and so when I say I try to get stuff off of him, I'm not trying to say I want to drop an elbow the way Telly Blanchard does. I tried to watch how he manipulated the crowd and how, you know, little things that he did that other guys, heels would, you know, bad guys would pull the hair, poke the eyes and stuff. You know, that's typical bad guy stuff. Tully was, you know, it was more of a mind game. It was your facial expressions. It was the attitude. It was the walk. It was arrogance. It was the wrestling. It was, you know, he knew when to back off at the right time. He knew when to, you know, beat the shit out of the guy and then let the guy do whatever he had to. You know, he was just the top bad guy that, you know, in the business. And you know, it's, there's very few guys that would say, you know, that would say, no, that's not true. Lex Luger was, you know, best bad guy ever, or whoever, you know. It's, not many people will argue that point.
Yeah. One of my co-hosts is unfortunately unable to do the show tonight. He's described Tully in a way that he says that there's nothing likable about Tully Blanchard, and he says that in the good way of getting heat. Like, there's almost no way you want to get, like, he did turn babyface once in San Antonio, but as far as his rest of his career, he's one of those guys where it really wouldn't have worked for him being a babyface. He's just, everything about him was like about making, he just, you couldn't like the guy, you know, and he was just so great at that.
Right, exactly. I mean, he was a good guy for a little while, but it was more about the guy, the bad guy he was facing more than, you know, all of a sudden he's changed his ways. He's a straight guy now. He was still Tully Blanchard, the same guy. It was just that the guy he was facing, I think he might have been Dick Slater or somebody, was
I think it was Jonathan Boyd, because I think Boyd had beat up Joe Blanchard on TV once.
There you go, exactly. And then Tully came to save his dad. But it was still Tully Blanchard, though. Still the same guy. You know, it was just the guy that he was fighting with. You're right, it was Jonathan Boyd.
Yeah. Now, speaking of Jonathan Boyd, I know I've heard he's a very eccentric character, and he booked Southwest for a while. He was actually, when the Sheepers first came, it was actually him and Luke Williams, and then he was, like, injured in a car wreck. It's what the storyline was.
Yeah,
I'm not sure what the real story was. But then they brought in Butch Miller. But what was Jonathan Boyd like? Because, like I say, I heard he was a very unique character.
One, he did get a car wreck. That wasn't a storyline. He really did get a car wreck. And it left him pretty bad shape. Jonathan Boyd, though, was, I mean, he was a very smart man. You saw what he did with Southwest Wrestling. You know, he turned it around. He was a lot of business with them. I mean, some guys, as I've learned through the years, do favors for their buddies, and sometimes it doesn't work out that way. You know, it doesn't work out for the good of the company. But Boyd, you know, he brought guys in and he brought in the Sheepers, and he brought in Tank Patton and the Fabulous Blonde. He had Eric Embry. He fed him. You know, he had the good guys. He had Manny Fernandez, Al Perez, and Chavo Guerrero. And I mean, he just and Scott Casey. And they brought in Eddie Mansfield to do a deal with Scott Casey. I mean, he was a very, very smart man. I mean, then when he left, I believe Luke Williams took over, and there was a little bit of a drop off, not a whole lot. But when Luke left, and then I don't remember who took over after that, they kind of like, hey, you
is
saw
it Bob?
Sweet Tan?
Yeah.
I don't remember, to be honest with you. I'm not sure. I just know that there was a drop-off. When the Sheepers left, there was a drop-off.
Yeah. Sadly, like, if you look at the old After Mags, and you look at the top tens, they have all the territories. And sadly, Southwest was actually like the first territory to drop off of that list. They had some great days for Southwest, and then sadly, you know, they started going. It kind of went down. They lost TV on USA.
Right.
There was a lot of problems between Joe Blanchard and Fred Barron. And Fred Barron, I think he got World Class TV in San Antonio, and that kind of they were just taking off. And like you say, the Sheepherders had left, and it kind of come down. And And sadly, as a fan kid at the time, it seemed like World Class just kind of came into Southwest's own hometown and kind of like took over, you know. And then like Southwest became Texas All Stars. So what were your feelings at the time when this was going on?
I was working for Joe, and I was very, you know, very loyal to him. I mean, there were guys that ran, like, little outlaw promotions around San Antonio, and they would try and get some of us to work for them. And I asked Joe, and Joe was like, what are they going to do for you? You know, and you know, we put you on TV, we can make you a star, you know. And so I had a lot of loyalty to Joe. So when he, you know, he pulled me in the office one day and said, I'm going to close down and sell the company. And I was like, what do I do? And he was like, I suggest, Rudy, you call Fritz, not Fritz, you guys just call Fritz and tell Fritz you work for me. I'm sure they know who you are, and tell him you want a job. He'll put you to work. I'm sure he will. So, yes, there was a fallout a few years before with Fred and Joe, and Fred was now working for Fritz. And he had an office, as a matter of fact, not even a mile away from Joe's office. It was a world-class office. And so I called Fritz, and Fritz was like, yes, sir, I guess they already knew, they had an idea, or they may have heard something that Joe's going to sell the company or whatever. So Fritz was like, yeah, since you live in San Antonio, call Fred Barron. And I was like, I don't want to call Fred Barron. He burned Joe. Why do I want to call this guy? So I asked Joe about it. He said, you know what, Rudy? He goes, it's a good way for you to learn. You know, Fred's not a very good person, but, you know, you need to learn, you know, you told me you want to learn this business. So I went to go for Fred. And then Fred ended up starting his own promotion and tried burning Fritz. And then and I worked for Fred for a little while, and then a whole big schmoz ended up happening with Fred, and he ended up shutting down also. But I was able to work for Fritz for a little while in between there, and worked with World Class and the Von Erich boys. I mean, the thing is, when everything kind of clicked, you know, at the right time. I mean, the Von Erichs were, They just got hot. I mean, there was everything was Kerry Von Erich and Kevin Von Erich, and David had passed away, and then Kerry got the world title, and I mean, they were on fire, and then they started having their own little trouble stuff also, but working for the difference that I had that I saw working for Joe and Fritz was. With Joe, I mean, the Sheepherders, and Manny and Al Perez, those guys, they were the main event guys. But like you pointed out earlier, there was a flow of guys that were coming in and out. Magnum TA started off, I'm sure he started off, but he went through Southwest Wrestling. He became a huge star in the Mid-Atlantic area.
I remember he had a TV match against Nick Bonkwinkle. It was a non-title match. He met Nick Bonkwinkle, and it was fantastic, and it was on San Antonio TV. It was great.
Right. I mean, World Class, I mean, it was more at Southwest. It was more about, how can I put it, next man up. If the Fabulous Blondes could have worked the main event with anybody, if the Sheepherders couldn't make a town. I mean, it was different guys that could pull into the main events part, the main event status, to fill in. At World Class, it was all Von Erichs. And, the Freebirds came in, and who do they work with? The Von Erichs. And then Gino had jumped ship, and he went and worked up there, and it was Gino and Chris Adams. Who did they work with? The Von Erichs. Kamala and Devastation Incorporated, Gary versus the Von Erichs. Everything revolved around the Von Erichs. And I feel like the better promotion was, and this may be my loyalty, I don't know. The better promotion was the Southwest, because everybody had a part everybody had a role to fill and to step up into the next slot if needed. At World Class, Black Bart versus Kerry Von Erich, it was, everything revolved around the boys, but I mean, they did good business, though. They the boys were very over. They were very popular.
Yeah, I mean, as far as business-wise, they had like a 3-4 year period that was just, like, they stayed on fire. And I remember like going to all the shows. I wanted to go back to Fred Barron real quick. Like you said, Joe didn't have like the best relationship with him, and I had Dusty Wolf on the show a couple years ago, and he basically, the only thing he really said about Fred Barron was that he basically took over Southwest to be as like a, what do you say, like a front for his drug operations.
Fred Barron was a drug dealer, and I don't know how much Dusty went into this, but. Dusty Wolf was on the road a lot, so he didn't really work too much with Fred. I did, and Fred Barron was a drug dealer. He was a shithead, and I could tell you stories all night about stuff like the ticket lady coming into the dressing room and saying how, someone robbed her at the box office and took all her money, but yet she never called the cops, that was something he put her up, I'm sure he put her up to, bouncing checks. I mean, he was just, guys today talk about, oh, this promoter's, don't work with him, he's a shithead, he's, don't trust this guy. Fred Barron was the epitome of just a guy you just didn't want to, didn't want to mess with. He burned Joe Blanchard. He ended up burning Fritz. To collect insurance, he blew up the wrestling office. He actually didn't do it. He had somebody else do it.
Wow.
And then I'm not exactly sure how the story goes, but the guy that he had do it, he had do all his dirty deeds or whatever, was going to talk to the authorities about some of the stuff that he had done. And So the story goes where Fred had a hitman go to kill this guy. And the story I heard was the hitman called up this guy and said, "Hey, man, Fred wants me to shoot you." And so this guy's like, well, go right ahead and try it. And so the guy shows up to his house, and the guy shoots him first and kills him. And then he goes and gets the authorities and stuff, and Fred gets thrown in prison. But he was just not a nice guy
I heard he wasn't a nice guy, but wow, some of the stories you just told right now, it's like, I'm surprised he's not more known for some of those stories. But a little bit after this time, I think it was, Texas All-Star Wrestling, they had a tag team called the American Force, and I think we actually got into an argument on Facebook about who the actual original American Force was. I thought it was Frankie Lane and Paul Diamond, and you said it was Diamond and Kaminsky. And
I think you're right. I think it was Frankie. He was here briefly, and that was
very
Fred
briefly.
All-Star Wrestling. Yeah, like for a few, I don't even think a month. He was here for a little while. But that was Fred's promotion, and it was Frankie Lang and Nick Kaniski, and then Frankie left, and then it was Nick Kaniski and Paul Diamond, and then Nick left, and then it was Paul Diamond and Sean.
Yeah, and that's what most people know of the team of the American Force, but that was very early in Sean's career. I think he wrestled a little bit in Southwest, and he was a little bit of a jobber in Mid-South, and he came back to Southwest then. What was Shawn Michaels like back then? Because I was like, I mean, we're talking about he became one of the greatest performers of all time.
Shawn, in all honesty, I had no clue who he was. When Shawn started training, I was already wrestling, and I had to go on a road trip somewhere. I had to pick up Ken Johnson. And Ken told me to pick me up at this building over here at 1 o'clock or something. And so I went to go pick him up, and he was training with Sean in the ring, and Jose Lothario was outside the ring giving him instruction. So I let him do whatever. I was standing there watching it. And, I stood there for a little while, but they finished up. And then the word dry, I asked Ken, who was that guy? He's some kid, Jose's training, And ended up being Sean. I didn't really talk to him during his training days, when he went through Jose sent him to Mid-South to start, start working. And then Fred had the idea to bring back the local kid, so they brought Sean back, and he went and worked with, and he came back and worked here. And he was in a different group. I still kind of do, is kept to myself. I didn't really talk to Paul Diamond a whole lot. I didn't talk to me and Nick Kaniski would get in the ring and roll around and wrestle, shoot wrestle for a little bit. Nick was an alternate on the Canadian wrestling team, so I would just get in the ring with him just to try and learn something from him, even though he would stretch me from here from ring post to ring post. But there was a kid named Paul Kelly, who was a good dude. I didn't really talk to a whole lot of the guys. So Sean was here briefly, and then him and Paul split up, and I believe Sean ended up going either to Kansas City or he went to Minneapolis, and that's where he got hooked up with Marty, and then the rest is history.
Yeah. Coming up a few years. I got to stop with, and the Texas promotions kind of went away. I didn't see you for quite a while. And then I went to a very rare, I guess it was WCW at the time. It was when Sting and El Gigante were there. And they had a house show. And I guess a couple guys didn't show up. And they had the Hard Knocks, which I believe were Dick Slater and Dick Murdoch. And they wrestled you and Solomon Grundy. And, what can you tell us about that time?
That was kind of like the beginning of the indies. Because like you said, the Texas promotions, died down. There was Global up in Dallas, or it might have been USA, wrestling or whatever. But this was when everything was starting to get kind of screwy. So you would try and catch on wherever, get in with the promotion. What I ended up doing was, I went to Mexico. I wasn't six, at that time it was Luger, Carey, and Dan Spivey, and all these 6'6" guys and bodybuilder guys. I was nothing like that. I went down to Mexico and started working. And I did a couple of shows up in Dallas with Global, and come back down, and then I started working like indie, then they started, they started becoming indie promotions in Corpus and Austin and wherever, and it was a different time, though. You went from going, like with Joe, we would go to Austin to the City Coliseum, and I would wrestle Tony Falk in the opening match, and the main event was Tim Brooks versus whoever. And the City Coliseum was packed. I mean, I refereed a show one time there, and a fan stabbed Tim Brooks the thigh with a pocket knife.
Oh, wow.
Now, Southwood Wrestling is gone, World Class is gone. These guys are opening up their own little, guys are building rings and opening up their own little, quote unquote promotions. Now I go back to Austin, and there's a guy named George who has a ring inside a TV studio, and a one row of chairs are on three sides of the ring, I believe, and those aren't even full, and he's trying to record a TV show, and I'm like, Jesus Christ, this is how far it's dropped already, and you're struggling for money. I went to Corpus and worked for a guy, and I was supposed to have gotten paid $100 or something. And he gives me, we didn't have as many people as we thought we were going to have. So I can only give you, you know, I can't give you your pay, you know, like what we agreed on. And I'm like, okay, I mean, what can you do? I mean, some, I know you hear, you may hear some stories of guys will like flip over desks and choke the guy out or something, but I, that wasn't me. So, you know, okay, well, that's fine. Pay me what you can. And the guy gave me a roll of quarters.
Oh, man.
So, yeah. But, I mean, working for Joe, if you touched a ring, you got paid. I mean, Joe was, the guys, you know, will tell you, Manny, Slater, Magnum, Dusty, Ricky Morton, all the older guys will tell you, Joe was a great payoff guy. I mean, I wrestled in Paulin, Texas, an afternoon show. It was like six of us or something. It was me. I know Embry was there. I don't know, like six of us. And I had a mask, and I wrestled as myself, and then as a good guy. And then the third match, I wrestled with a different outfit, a mask on. I was El Gato Negro. And then, so that was twice that I wrestled at that town. And then at 7 o'clock, we wrestled in Austin, Texas, and I wrestled as myself in the first match. And then I wrestled as El Gato Negro in the third match. And then I did a battle royal at the end. So I wrestled five times in one day. I got paid for five matches by Joe.
Wow.
Joe was, you know, I never had an issue, you know, as far as I knew. I mean, pro wrestling was like this great business to be in. I had a guy was driving me somewhere, and he ran into the back of a bus. My head went through the windshield. Joe cut me a check, for a couple of $1,000s and said, take your time coming back, you know, but as soon as you're able to start wrestling again, let me know, and I'll have Jonathan book you again. So he gave me a check for a good amount of money, and I sat out. Then I go over for Fred, and it was a nightmare. Is, you know, I had to take the ring from San Antonio to, I don't know, Corpus or something, and, you know, Fred was, you know, told me, I don't have my credit card, but do you have any money on you? I said, yeah, I got some money. Okay, pay for the gas, and when you get back to San Antonio, I'll reimburse you. I never got reimbursed. That didn't happen once. That didn't happen twice. That happened. All in all, he ended up owing me like $400. And my dad, you know, screw me once, you know, shame on you. Screw me twice, shame on me. And then it was like, screw me three times, shame on me again. Screw me four times, shame on me. You know, but I mean, it's a learning experience. It was a learning experience for me, an expensive one. But, you know, I saw the difference between Joe and Fred and how, you know, all promoters aren't alike. And then I worked a couple of weeks for Bill Watts. That was another deal. That was, and Bill was very fair, and he was, I refereed it, and it was a learning experience for me also. It was, you know, Fritz was another deal. He was, you know, I didn't really interact with him that much, but the few times I did, I mean, I never had an issue with him, and it was, you know, it was mainly, how you doing, Rudy? I'm doing good, great, you know, doing a good job, thank you, sir, you know, that type of stuff.
Uh-huh.
So when the indies come around, you know, and it became, you know, it became like a regular thing where, you know, hey, man, I have a show Saturday, you know, I can give you $100. All right, I'll be there. And then the show happens, and, you know, I'm sorry, bro, but, you know, and then it was becoming a regular thing. So it got to where, hey, bro, you know, hey, Rudy, I got a show next week. Can you come work and give you, you know what, don't tell me how much you're going to give me. I'll be there. You know, and I go back, and I go back to when that was happening, where Joe told me in that long speech he gave me way back when, you know, don't get into this for the money, because you may not make any. There's got to be something you want to do, you know. And so, like now, I'm on my way right now to Memphis, Tennessee. I'm not going to make a whole lot of money, but I want to be there. I want to help the promotion, and I want to work with the guys that I'm working with. And so, you know, it's not, you know, again, Joe told me, you're not going to make a whole lot of money doing this, and so I'm not asking for a whole lot of money. All I'm asking is my expenses paid, give me something to eat in a hotel room, and you know, I mean, and the promotion takes care of me, though. I mean, I'm not going to say, you know, I'm scrounging here, but you know, if you were to call me and say, Rudy, can you come help me with this show, whatever, I'm not going to say, hey man, you know, my guarantee is $500, bro. I need a hotel and I need my gas paid for and I need to stay at the Days Inn. Guys that are like that, they have no clue. They don't, you know, that's the perfect world. But when I worked for Joe and when I worked for Fritz and when I worked for Bill and even when I worked for Vince and Ted Turner, they never guaranteed. I mean, I got paid well, but they didn't, you know, Vince McMahon never said, Dusty Wolf got me this spot with WWF. And, you know, Dusty said, yeah, let's take care of you. He didn't say, yeah, you're guaranteed X amount of dollars. No one ever guaranteed me anything. Joe told me years ago, there's no guarantees. So, you know, that's something I've always kept in the back of my head or in my pocket, you know. It makes you appreciate what you're doing, what I'm doing. I don't mind this drive that I'm making. It makes you appreciate when you do get that payday that much more than. And it makes you understand exactly what you're doing this week.
Yeah, and I see on your Facebook, I mean, you take road trips all the time. I mean, weren't you just in, like, New Orleans not too long ago?
That was just a stop. We were we were in North Carolina. And, yeah, we did Gallatin, Tennessee, Friday, and then Saturday we made a six-hour drive to Mount Airy, North Carolina for the AIWF anniversary show. I did a clinic, and then we wrestled that night, and on the way back, you know, went to New Orleans and stuff like that. This is a great job to have. I mean, you get paid to travel, and, you know, like Claudia Solis, I don't know if you saw one of her Facebook things where she talked about, we stopped in Memphis we stopped in Memphis at the Lorraine Hotel where Martin Luther King got shot. And I read about that. Yeah, I read about that place when I was in high school. And, you know, when MLK Day comes around every year, you hear about the marches and, you know, they'll talk about the shooting and what happened and the conspiracy stuff and all this stuff. But to be actually on those grounds, 20 feet from the actual door where he stood by or where he was shot at, or, you know, it sends a chill down your spine. It makes you just realize where, you know, what this country what we've gone through with this country. Or, like, I'm going to drive through Tennessee in a little while, and I'm gonna go by Civil War landmarks and stuff. There was a huge war that went on in Tennessee, and we don't realize the magnitude of it. I mean, you know what I'm saying? I'm able to drive through history. You know, when we were doing the Ring of Honor shows, me, Masada, Don Juan, and Fast Eddie stopped about 6 months after, six, seven, 8 months after the World Trade Centers were blown up. And that was a scary feeling. You're sitting there and you look up in the sky, and at one time there was these huge buildings, now they're gone. And you're standing on the sidewalk where thousands of people died, you know, jumped out of the buildings for whatever reason. You know, I mean, you're standing in this death trap. I don't know what you want to call it, but, you know, this is a great job to have. You can go all these places and what have you and visit, you know, these historical markers. You know, I enjoy it.
Yeah. I mean, that must be great. Like, you know, I mean, every year I go to WrestleMania. So, I mean, that's only like, you know, I get to go to the Manhattan Center. Or we went to ROH where they taped Florida wrestling in Miami, and, you know, and then, you know, all the historical stuff that goes around it, which is great. So I can only imagine how it is for when you get to drive and, you know, take your time and get to see more of the world. So, I mean, that's actually, you know, that's actually pretty cool. I want to move up ahead and get to where you were, you became a trainer. When Shawn Michaels had to retire, he opened up a wrestling school and he hired you as a trainer. And for people who don't know, you had a hand in bringing up probably the most over wrestler currently in the WWE, Daniel Bryan. You had a hand in training him. How did you get the job as a trainer, and what was it like training not just Bryan Daniel, but you trained Spanky, Paul London, the late Lance Cade, quite a few other, Matt Bentley, Hernandez, a bunch of other guys. Tell us about that.
So, back to the indies and stuff, I did a show in Laredo, Texas, and there was a huge crowd there, and I got paid $25, and I was done. I was tired of, I wasn't guaranteed any money again, but I'm sitting in I worked the main event with a couple of Lucha guys and stuff, and, I see one guy getting an envelope, and he opens it, there's a bunch of bills in there, and a guy that wrestled his first match, he opens it, there's a bunch of bills and stuff, and I don't know what he got paid. I open my envelope, and I get a 20 and a 5, and I'm like, you know what, screw this. So I quit. I was done with wrestling. This was in, this was about November of 98, November, October of 98. And I forgot who I drove down there with, but I got in my truck and I came home. I just grabbed my bags, threw my bag back in the truck. I drove home in my wrestling gear, my boots, my trunks, my knee pads, and I just threw a sheet T-shirt on. Got pumped gas down the street. The lady's like, oh, let's go. Oh, shut up. And I'm done. So a couple of weeks after that, I'm sitting watching TV, and my phone rings, and I answer it, and like, hello? Like, is this Rudy? I said, yes, it is. This is Sean. Hey, I'm going to start a wrestling school, and I'd like to sit down and talk to you about being one of my trainers. And I was like, Sean who? And he said, Sean Michaels. Shut up, dude. Like, who is this? Is this Sean? No, it's not. I mean, come on. Did I really, Sean, like I said before, we weren't buddies. Whenever I did the WWF shows with them, it was like, hey, Sean, what's going on? Hey, Rudy, how you doing? And that was it. We never talked about the kids. We didn't talk about how's your mom and dad. We didn't talk about having a barbecue together, a couple of beers afterwards. The first match that he did when he turned heel, when he switched, when he turned on Marty, was with me, and I found out later that he asked for that match. But I didn't find that out until later. So he calls me and he's like, this is Sean. I'm like, Sean who? He says, Sean Michaels. Dude, who is this? He goes, this is Sean. So I hung up on him. True story. I hung up on him. And my phone rings again, and I'm like, hello, Rudy, this is Sean. I said, Sean, who is this? And he's, and guys did ribs all the time, so that's what I thought it was. It's a Sean Higginbotham. I'm like, not Sean. Who the F is, who is this? And he goes, it's Sean. I'm like, dude, if you don't tell me who you want, I'm hanging up. I'm telling you, this is Sean. Click, I hang up on him. Phone rings again. Hello. Don't hang up on me. Well, who is this? It's Sean. Well, what do you want? Well, I told you, I'm looking at starting, I'm going to have back surgery. And I knew Sean was having back surgery. I'm going to be out for a while, and I'd like to start a school, and I'd like for you to be one of the trainers. And, I was like, all right, what do I got to do? And he was like, well, can you go to the Jose, Jose Lothario had a show on Fridays. He goes, can you go to Jose's show Friday and I can talk to you there? And I thought there was somebody playing a rib and they're trying to get me to go to the show. And once I'm there, hey, Rudy, can you do a run-in or can you get involved in this match? So I'm like, I'm not going to Jose's show. Well, I'm not asking you to wrestle. He said, I'm not asking you to wrestle. I just want you to show up. We can talk. Just give me a couple of minutes. Well, I'll go, but I'm not working. He goes, I'm not asking to work. I'm not asking to wrestle. I just want to talk to you for a couple of minutes. So I was like, all right, I didn't know what was going on. So Friday night show comes around. I show up. The show starts. Sean's not there. I knew it was a rib, and I was getting pissed. But I wasn't going to put it over. I wasn't going to get up like, what the F, you guys got me. Yeah. I hate you guys. I just was going to sit there and wait till the matches got started, and then I was going to kind of like walk out. So the matches got started, and I was getting ready to walk out of the building, and all of a sudden the whole, he probably had about 100 people there. Everybody just like flocks to the door. And I look, and you see all these kids, and, you know, there's adults or whatever, and you see Sean standing over them, you know, walking through the crowd. And I was like, holy shit, that is Sean. And so he walks through the crowd, and he walks by me. He doesn't say anything to me. And I was like, yeah, they got me. That was a and then he comes back and says, hold on, don't leave until I'll be right back. So he goes in the back. I don't know what he did back then. He comes back, he goes, okay, I'm going to have surgery in a couple of weeks. I'm going to be out for a while, yada, yada, yada. I got Jose Lothario and Ken as my trainer. They're the guys that trained me. And but I want another guy in there. I like your work. You know, really respect what you do. I've always kept an eye on you, and you know, I want you to be one of my trainers. And, you know, like I said, I had quit the business. I was done. I had a job at the ATV warehouse. I was making, you know, $14 an hour, you know, $800 a week, you know. So I was like, well, what's the pay? And he was like, well, starting off, I can only give you, he said, I can only give you $250. And I'm like, all right, how am I going to explain this to my kids and mom? I'm going from $800 a week plus to $250. How am I going to, you know, but, you know, then I was like, well, let me think about it. So, you know, on the way home, I was thinking, how am I going to explain this? How am I going to take this pay cut? How am I going to, you know, and then I just said, you know what, I'll do it. So when I got home, I just told her, said, you know, Sean asked me to run a school for him with Jose and Ken. And, you know, she was, of course, you know, well, I thought you quit wrestling. And I was, well, you know, but it's Sean. And, you know, I mean, what can you say? I mean, Sean was at the height of his deal. I mean, he was the guy. And, you know, when someone like Sean asked you to, you know, to be part of his whatever, I mean, sports, you want to be part of it, you know? And so I was like, well, I go, you know what, I'm going to leave, I'm going to quit, you know, HEB, but I'm going to quit on Victor, so that if anything happens, I'll go back. And so she's like, well, I hope you know what you're doing. And, of course, there was some conflict there. I'm not gonna lie. And so we started with me, Sean, Jose Lothario, and Ken Johnson. And we started training guys. Something happened with Sean and Jose. Jose still had the old school mentality of beating the guys a little bit to make them respect the business. But one thing that we talked about in the beginning was, you know, I envisioned this as a wrestling school, not a wrestling boot camp beatdown. You know, I mean, that's Shawn Michaels. It's, you know, it's not Joe Blow. It's not just any guy. It's you know, Sean had a name that, you know, he has a name in the business. It's, you know, I told him if we hurt one of these guys, they're not going to come after me. They're not going to come after Jose or Ken. They're going to come after you. So why don't we train these guys? I mean, and if we train them, I mean, we can still do the boot camp type stuff. We just don't touch them. We don't physically hurt them. You know, I mean, just, we don't go grab them by the neck. You know, I was at one of the training sessions with the Path of Power plant, and man, Sarge was crazy. He would get in the guy's faces and scream and holler, and, you know, I mean, that wasn't, I mean, and guys were like throwing up everywhere and stuff, and that just wasn't us. We just made the guys train, and the guys one by one figured out, you know, this is for me, and so they quit on their own. We didn't touch anybody. We didn't abuse anybody. We didn't, you know, put anybody down or, you know, you sorry, MAGA, you're not going to, nothing like that. We just, you know,
yeah,
did our thing, and we treated all the kids with respect. And you saw the kids that, you know, Brian Kendrick walked in and he had went to another wrestling school up in Dallas, and the guy there charged him $2,500 and trained him for a couple of weeks. The story that Brian told me was, trained him for a few weeks, and then put him in a match, so he got his match in, and then after the match was over, he told Brian, you're too small, kid, you'll never make it to business. And Brian was like, I'm the same size as I was 3 weeks ago. Why didn't you tell me this before you took my money? So, you know, the guy's like, well, that's the way it is, kid, too bad. And so ran him off, and so, you know, then Sean told him, You're not too small. That's not for me to say. And I agree with you. That's not for us to say you're too small or you're too fat, you're too big, you're too dumb, you're too whatever, you know, you're the guy that's gonna you know, get your foot in the door. We'll help you. We'll give you all the tools you need, but I mean, you're the one that's gonna be doing all this stuff. I don't know what's inside you. I don't know what kind of drive you have. So we had guys that were 6'6" or 240, 250 that quit after two or three days. Meanwhile, 5'8" Brian Danielson, 180 pounds, is going like, you know, going through training like a madman. 5'7" Brian Kendrick, 170 pounds, is going through his deal like a madman. 6'6", 280 pound, this guy named Keith, quit. You know, so, you know, we let them do what they, you know, whatever it was that they were doing. We pushed them. Great kids. You know, their attitudes were out of this world. I mean, anything you asked them to do, they would do. They wouldn't, you know, like some guys, even now, I train guys, you know, in my school, and I'll say, okay, do this. And they'll question, well, why do I got to do that? Well, because I'm asking you to. Yeah, well, that makes no sense. Well, I'm sorry if doing four sets of squats makes no sense to you, but that's part of the warm-ups. Well, I don't see why I got to do. Well, you know what? If you don't like it, you can leave. You know, we never caught any attitude from those guys. There were a lot of kids that were like that in Shaw School. And then when they had their opportunity to get their tryout, I mean, with Vince, I guess he told Sean, or Sean might have asked him, hey, can I get some guys to look with him? And Vince said, yeah, you know, you got four guys. Me and him sat down, and we evaluated. There was like seven kids that, you know, that we were debating over. And Lance, you know, we chose Lance because of his size and his look. I mean, he was a good-looking, blonde-haired, blue-eyed kid. He had the size. Very athletic, very agile for his size. Brian Kendrick, Brian Danielson, they worked their tails off. They just never missed a day, never, you know, never questioned anything, good attitude. And then there was a kid named Chris Schultz, same thing, worked his butt off, very paid attention to detail, questioned stuff, but only to help his work. He didn't question to dispute anything. He just, hey, Reed, would it make sense if I, you know, whatever. And so those were the guys that got the tryout. Everybody else, you know, one guy may have missed a day of training or something, or 2 days of training, or maybe one guy, you know, wasn't quite as in good shape as he should have been. You know, it was getting to where we're splitting hairs. And yeah. So they did their tryout, and they got signed with their developmental teams.
Yeah, I remember going to some of the shows, because it wasn't just like the rest of the school. I mean, basically Sean had his own little promotion and had TV here in town. And they would film, at first they filmed at Far West Rodeo, which I don't think it's called Far West anymore. Cowboy Dance Hall, I think it's called now.
Yeah, right.
And I went to the show where they brought in Just Incredible. And
right.
That was like one hell of a show. To me it felt like San Antonio was starting like its own ECW, like the way ECW was in Philadelphia. And
right.
It was a hell of a show. I remember you wrestled with, was it Bone Crusher?
Bone Crusher, right.
Yeah, Bone Crusher, and you wrestled Matt Bentley and Kruger, I believe.
Chris Kruger.
And I remember, I don't know if it was Kruger or Bentley, but they took a dive off the second story on Bone Crusher to a table. It was a hell of a show. I mean, it was fantastic. And just even back then, you could watch Danielson and Spanky, and especially Danielson. And it's like, I saw him, and I'm like, man, this kid, he's going to be a star one day. I mean, he was so skinny and white as like a all get out, but it's like, man, this kid's got something. And I go, he's gonna become something. And go ahead.
Oh, Sean actually ran a show. He ran a promotion. He ran some shows out of this place called the Blue Bonnet off of 35, and drew nobody. And he had a lot of older guys, myself, Ken Johnson, Chaz Taylor, Wayne Knight. Solomon Grundy, who else was there? Ricky Gonzalez, some guy named Jaguar. I don't know. He was from Houston. There are a lot of older guys. There was conflict with some of the...
I didn't even know about those Blue Bonnet shows. And, I follow wrestling big time, and I'm from San Antonio.
They didn't draw. I mean, there was always a conflict about who's going over, who's not going over, how long are we going, how come he's the main event stuff. And from the get-go, Sean was already getting, why am I doing this, So when we were doing the training, after a few, 2 months, 2 to 8 weeks or so, we started having the guys do matches based on what we taught them, what we covered. And all we covered were just the basics. We didn't teach anybody how to do hurricanranas. We didn't teach anybody how to do dives out of the ring, or we didn't even teach guys how to do chair shots. I mean, nothing like that. We didn't teach it. One guy did ask, how do you hit another guy with a chair? And Sean just got a chair and whacked against the ring post like that. Just like that. And everybody's like, oh, shit. But the guys started, all the guys were doing their matches, their student matches, and after the first couple of days, by this time, Jose was gone and Ken was gone. And so, me and Sean, we would talk about training and whatever. We'd have our little powwow. And I told him, I was like, I have a feeling we're going to have a whole different crew in about 3 weeks. Sean's like, why you say that? Like, all these guys just want to work. And they just, they're putting everything they have. Even though some of the matches were funny and were goofy, some of the stuff they were doing didn't make sense. They were trying. And there was no, I've been doing this longer than you. I shouldn't have to put you over, that type of stuff. They just went out there, and all the guys, it was balls to the wall. And I told these guys are all, they're all pure. They're all, naive. They don't have any kind of, attitude. They just want to work, And I remember having a match with one of the, I forget who it was, at the Blue Bonnet, and the guy didn't want to put me over, And to me, that's it didn't matter to me, but it was just, why, And it becomes a pride thing. Well, if you're not going to put me over, I'm going to put you over. And, these guys had no, the students had nothing like that within their soul. I mean, they didn't know anything about it. All they wanted to do was work. And so I told Sean, I think within a few weeks we'll have a whole different crew. And then we start talking about, well, who would you get rid of first? Well, I'd get rid of this guy first and replace him with that guy. And then we'd get rid of this guy and replace him with this guy. And sure enough, Sean, and it just coincidentally, Sean started doing TV. And he did keep Chaz. He did keep Wayne Knight. He had Paul Diamond there. Ken was gone already. Bobby Perez was gone. Mombasa was there for a little while, and then he left. As each student was getting ready, we just, the guy that carried less weight, we just moved him out. And it was a business decision. I mean, the guys were, the part of the students' deal was to have matches anyway. So, I know there were two guys called the Ultimate Bad Guys, and one guy was cool as shit. He played football with Walter Payton, nice guy. The other guy, I guess he was okay. He just had an attitude about him. But I know they had a match with Brian Kendrick and Brian Danielson, and they squashed him. And Sean went to town. When they got to the back, Sean went to town. He just like, these guys are my students. They're better. They work their asses off. They don't deserve that shit. What the fuck's wrong with you guys? You guys need to work with them. Who the heck do you think you are? Where the hell have you ever been? And these guys are like, well, Sean, look how big we are. Look how big they are. I don't give a F what you, he just went off on them. And when it came time for Brian Danielson and to have his first match, who was it against? It was against me. And Sean was like, what do you want to do? I said, no, Brian said, what do you want to do? I said, Brian, you do whatever you want to do. I'll follow you. And he was like, no, you're my coach. You're like, no, Brian. We were in Cotulla, Texas. If you're going to Laredo and you go through Cotulla, there's like a little civic center on the left. That's the trivia question. Where was Brian Danielson's first wrestling match? right at that little Civic Center, Petula, against me. So, you know, we did our match, but Brian blew my ass up. I mean, my mistake was letting him do whatever he wanted to do. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I'm not that proud. He blew my ass up. And it was like, he did something. All right, what next? And then he's like, okay, I'm going to come off the ropes with a flying something. Go right ahead. And then he, whatever. Then, all right, well, what do you want to do? Okay, let me get a forearm in here. Boom, a forearm. All right, I'm going to shoot you off and then crossbody. And he'd jump half higher. You know, I had to jump up to catch him. You know, Brian was just this phenomenal worker. And then Brian Kendrick, his first match with me also. And then there was Lance, and there was Shooter, and there was Bone Crusher, Matt Bentley, Chris Krueger. Even this kid named CPA, I don't know if you remember him or not.
Was he like a little tiny guy? He was like a little tiny guy?
He wore like really black pants and a white shirt. Yeah. Black pants and a white shirt. He was like 23 years old, but he already had like, he already had like a receding hairline. Goofy kid, but he worked his butt off also. You know, so like I said, in time we just started getting rid of the older guys, and just all, you know, the shows that we did. I mean, when you were there, they were all students. We brought in just incredible, you know, one student, one TV guy, and I think the attendance on that show was 950 or something like that.
It was a long line outside. I remember that. It was the first time me and my buddy had gone to one of the shows. Was that one was just incredible, and it was packed. It was packed, and then I think they brought in the Sandman after that, and then a little bit later they moved to the YMCA. And I did not like the YMCA, but I did go to the show where they brought in Hardcore Holly and S.A. Rios, D'Lo Brown, Lita, and then the one where they brought in Kai and Ty. And I just wasn't a fan of the YMCA compared to Far West Rodeo at the time. But, I mean, great shows. I mean, the show with when they brought in Hardcore Holly, he wrestled Shooter Schultz. And it was one of those matches where I don't want to say Hardcore was taking liberties, but it was like he kind of was giving him a wrestling lesson. You know, I mean,
And Shooter was fighting back. I know exactly what you're talking about. And Shooter was fighting back at the same time. Not as much as, I mean, Holly gave him a little bit, but, I mean, whatever he gave him, Shooter was, you know, he took it. I mean, and it was good competitive match. I mean, and that's just the way Hardcore Holly was, or is, you know.
Yeah.
But at the end of the night, we were proud of him. He did a good job. It was a tough matchup. Shawn was... He wasn't mad at Bob Holly, but he was, you know, he was like, you know, a student, poor guy. And but you know, they talked, and they, you know, then Holly pulled Shooter to the side. They talked also, and everything was fine.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like he hit him anywhere he shouldn't have. He just was where, you know, he hit, like they say, you hit him in safe places, and he did that, but he did it very hard. But I mean, it was a good match, and it's like it's not like he was trying to kill him. I mean, it's a good learning experience. You know, I'm sure Shooter appreciated that a lot. And the other match they had, it was Danielson and Spanky against D'Lo and S.A. Rios, the Lita, and that was one hell of a match. I mean, that was, I mean, you won't see a better match than that on the majority of the indie shows you go to. I mean, it was great, and they hung with those guys, like, you know, all the way. They hung with them all the way. It was just fantastic.
And that was what I was getting to Sean at that time when we talked was those, you know, you're talking about that match, those guys, Brian and Brian, had only been wrestling for a few months at that point. It wasn't like they were seasoned veterans or anything. It wasn't like they were five-year guys or anything. They had only wrestled once every couple of weeks, you know, for Sean. And by the time we got to the West Side Y, I believe, was like 6-7 months or something after far, maybe it's less than that. So they weren't like you see them vets or anything. And like you said, they were able to you know, D'Lo didn't step down. He made them come up to his level, and neither did S.A. Rios. They made them come up to their level.
Yeah, and like I say, it was a great match. And then their opponents were, I forget the names of the guys, but basically one guy kind of looked like his look was like a Mean Street Posse, and then the other guy kind of looked like Like, he wore like
Ruben
a long
Cruz.
White shirt. The Board of Education, that's what the name was.
Yeah, Board of Education. Ruben Cruz and CJ, Ruben Cruz and Jeremy Sage.
Yeah, and I remember they had a match on. It was either a Raw or SmackDown. It was the dark match, and it was Danielson and Spanky against them. And usually, like, they always have these dark matches at WWE. I've gone to so many shows, and usually when they have these dark matches, the fans usually shit on the guys having the dark match because they don't know them. And
right.
They had this match, and this match, I swear to God, was the best match on the whole show. You know,
right.
You know, like the WWE match, the TV match, they don't get like a lot of time. This is the best show. People were going crazy. I mean, it was fantastic. I mean, and then I think they were signed right after that, if I'm not mistaken.
Spanky and Brian were already signed to contracts.
Okay.
They already had their deals. They were trying to, I'm not going to say help, but I mean, they were put in there because they're familiar with them. They were put in the match with Ruben Cruz and Jeremy Sage to help them a little bit, since they were familiar with them. There were some issues that came up in the back. I mean, I was there when they had that match. So unfortunately, Ruben and Siege and Jeremy Sage didn't get signed. But I mean, it was close to a point, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a great match. And you know, after that, they left the developmental, and unfortunately, I think they let go of Frankie and Danielson after not too long, and they also let go of Shooter, and he ended up, I guess he just totally retired after that.
Yeah, he quit the business. He was angry. I mean, Shooter was the guy that, I mean, he, as much as we, you know, because whatever it was that I learned through the years, and Sean, that, you know, whatever he learned through the years, we passed on to our students, to the kids that we're training. And we always, you know, same back to that speech Joe gave me years ago, you know, nothing's guaranteed, you know, there's no promises. Don't think you're entitled to anything. Don't expect anything. You're going to work your ass off. You may get nothing back in return. And Shooter, he just came off of being out for a while because I think he had a burger. I think he had surgery. I'm not exactly sure. And so he worked really hard to get back into shape again. And then I believe that's when WWE bought out WCW. And to make room for the new talent, they let go of all the small guys. They didn't let go of, like, Lance and the Samoan kids. They let go of Brian and Brian, a Shooter. And Joey Matthews was there. Who else was there? All the smaller guys they released. But they told each guy, you know, the door is still open for you to come back. Just go out and get more experience. And so Shooter was like, you know, he called. And when it happened, the first, I got the calls. Brian Danielson called me, and he was like, Rudy, I just got released. And I was like, what? And he goes, they just released. They're releasing all of us. And I was like, what happened? He goes, they said it's budgets, but it's budget cuts. But they said to go out and get worldly experience. What does that mean? That means to get, you know, to get on the road and travel and learn how to work different people. You know, here with us, they wrestle the same people over and over again. And then when they went to developmental, they wrestled the same guys again, over and over again. Go wrestle different promotions, different people. And that's where he got hooked up with Ring of Honor. And then there was a promotion ran by Roland Alexander in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I was about to bring that up. Like, Roland Alexander, who unfortunately he passed away not too long ago, but he was on Beyond the Mat. And it's funny because, like, he had this tournament called the King of Indies. And before the tournament was when he was just taking the fans to the tournament, he was a guest on Dave Meltzer's internet radio show at the time. And I called up. And I was like, hey, you know, if you're looking for people to have in your tournament, you know, there's this kid with the Shawn Michaels Academy, Daniel Bryan. You know, anyway, I'm sorry. I get confused because it's Bryan Danielson. Yeah, I was like, this kid, Bryan Danielson, you know, you should get him for your tournament. He'd be great. And he'd be like, well, I'll look into it. And
you know, I know Danielson a little bit, so I kid with him saying that that I helped get him booked on the tournament, which of course I didn't, but I kid him with about that. But basically, they had this tournament, and they had Danielson, they had just all these guys who became big stars, you know. And, you know, this tournament, basically, this is what kind of caused Ring of Honor to come about. And, you know, Bryan Danielson became, like, the biggest star in ROH for, like, a long time before he went to the WWE, where he's currently, like, the most over guy. I mean, every show you go, you got tens of thousands of people doing the Yes Chants. And when you were training him, I know you knew he was good, but did you ever in your wildest dreams think he could become, like, I don't want to say the top guy because Cena's the top guy, but, I mean, he's not far below Cena right now.
Honestly, we knew there was something there, but not like this, though. I mean, we would do shows in Cthulhu, like show in Cthulhu, we probably had 100 people there. You know, I mean, he came out as, you know, we would go to Carrizo Springs and there'd be 100 people there, 50 people, 30 people, I don't know. You know, we were in Laredo about a month ago, they were in Laredo, and he went out to the ring. So I, you know, usually I stay in the back. I take another guy over to get like a little trial thing. And so usually I stay in the back out of the way of everybody. But when Brian went out, right before he went out to the ring, I ran around to where the crowd was. And 12 years ago or whatever it was, 14 years ago, there was no way in the world you could tell me that 20,000 people are going to shout, yes, yes, in unison for that kid. No way in the world I would have believed you. I mean, he just, you know, he's just connected with the crowd so well, you know. It's unbelievable. And the thing is that, you know, you read on the internet all these, you know, all these fans and stuff, or a lot of them aren't even fans, or wrestlers themselves, indie guys, but they're like, oh my God, they're killing them, they're keep burying them. They keep beating them. They're not using them right. They're doing this to them. They're, you know, they're abusing them. They're, my God, the kid is more over with all the quote unquote abuse and not being treated right and not being used properly and all that. The kid is more over than anyone on the roster. You know.
As an example, the WrestleMania in Miami. He loses like a 9-second match, basically one move, kick to the face, loses his title, and somehow that propelled him to be even more over than he already was at the time.
Right. I mean, there's in wrestling business, if you beat a guy, you know, you can bury a guy by beating him different ways, whatever. You can hurt a guy's career by not, you know, what a lot of guys bring up. I mean, it's true. You can hurt a guy by not positioning him correctly, by, you know, not when, you know, putting them over the right way, whatever. You can hurt a guy's career that way. That is true. It's not working with Bryan Danielson, though. I mean, there's very few guys out there that you can jack around with and screw around with and just, you know, twist and whatever. And each time that you do that, instead of the crowd like, you know, this guy's never going to make it, each time you do that, the crowd just gets more and more behind him. And that's all they're doing with him. And they know that Brian has that connection. He's the underdog guy, you know. So I don't see this stopping anytime soon. In fact, I think Steve Austin said something like, tweeted something like, it's Yes the Mania time or something. You know, something like that.
Yeah. The thing that I admire about Daniel Bryan is that he's like, to give an example, me and him went to a UFC show in Vegas, and throughout the show, I would bring up different matches from the Texas Wrestling Alliance, matches from Ring of Honor, matches from Japan, and every match that I brought up, he would shake his head and almost get an embarrassed look on his face, and he would say to me, that match was horrible, you know,
yeah.
And then he said, I should have done this, I should have done that, and it's like, he's that driven that it's like he'll never ever accept that he's good. You know what I mean? He has to be better than he is. And
right,
like
right.
The guys that are like that, like Eddie Guerrero was like that, Chris Benoit,
you know, these the smaller guys, they have more against them, but it's like they have that drive that they're not going to, that they're just not going to stop, you know, and that's what I admire about him the most.
They're hungry, you know, and Brian at one point literally was hungry. He lived in an apartment off of Blanco Road in San Antonio, a one-bedroom apartment, two air mattresses, one air mattress was in the living room, one air mattress in the bedroom. He shared the apartment with one guy, the guy ended up leaving, and then he shared his apartment with Brian Kendrick. And they had a TV with videotapes, you know, of Japanese wrestling, of Lucha Libre wrestling, whatever. And, you know, there wasn't really much else in their apartment. I mean, I went into their apartment a couple of times to take them out, you know, pick them up to go places, whatever. But, like, a jar of peanut butter or a packet of tortillas and a bunch of cans of tuna. I mean, they didn't live, you know, they didn't live very, I mean, they couldn't live extravagant. I remember when I finally did get to where I showed them how to do a Hurricanrana, and I was like, all right, you're going to stand right here, you're going to jump on my shoulders, I'm going to catch you, and whatever. And Brian jumped up on my shoulders, and his shorts were in my face. I almost died. I was like, what the fuck is this? What is that smell? And he was like, I'm sorry. Well, I'm like, dude, when was the last time you washed your shorts? He was like, about 4 months ago. What? They couldn't know. He goes, I can't afford, Bill Rudy, we can't afford to wash our clothes. I'm like, you got to be kidding me, you know. So living, you know, where he's at now, I mean, he's very much deserves it. You know, I mean, and I'm very happy for him. I saw him, and we talked for a little while or whatever. And like you said, he was like, you know, he says something like, someone asked him a question. Oh, yeah, Rudy helped train me. I had the most horrible matches at Sean's wrestling school, you know. And I'm like, no, you didn't. I mean, him and Brian Kendrick had a match. One of their matches was like move for move, Chris Jericho versus Dean Malenko. Ask him about that. And just watched Monday Nitro, and I just happened to catch that show also. And they started doing their match, and I was like, wait a minute, that seems for it. And so they're doing something, whatever, and I told Sean, I'm like, watch, now they're going to do something flip. And then, bam, do a sunset flip. Okay, now Brian's going to shoot Brian into the ropes. He's going to do this. They did whatever. And, okay, now he's going to do it. Sean, I'm like, did you call me? Did you put this match together for him? No, it was on TV last night. That's Jericho and Malenko. It was last night. And so they finish their match, and then after everybody does their matches, they come to us and we critique them. And so Sean was like, did Rudy help you with that match? And they're like, no, sir. It's pretty good. Where'd you get it from? And then Brian Danielson said, Chris Jericho, Dean Malenko last night, Monday Nitro. Like I told you, that was funny. Good kids, though.
Yeah. That's cool. And we haven't talked a lot about Paul London. He also trained Paul London. And he had a good run in WWE. Unfortunately, I guess the story is that they were doing the angle where Vince McMahon was going to go outside and get blown up, and he was walking through the hall. And everybody was like, you know, I don't want to say sad, but they weren't like, you know, that's kind of like they were like kind of down. But when he walked by Paul London, London was smiling and kind of bouncing. And Vince even stopped and looked at him before he took off. And people say that's what kind of got him fired, was that he was acting like that. But what are your thoughts on Paul London? You know, he's kind of a wacky guy on the indies. And, I mean, a great wrestler. I mean, he's awesome. I mean, what are your thoughts on Paul London?
Very talented. Paul Paul can do anything. When I first got, you know, he came and did a tryout with a guy named Steve DeMarco, I want to say, at Sean's place. And I mean, you can tell when a guy has potential and when a guy doesn't. And so Sean was like, you know, they did their match. And then Sean would have to go somewhere. He's like, talk to the kid with straight hair. And I was like, what about the other one? And he was like, he just walked off. So that meant that, you know, DeMarco didn't impress him. So, Paul, they come over and they're like, what do you know? How do we do? I was like, well, you guys did pretty good. I told Paul, you're very athletic. You know, you can do a lot of stuff. You just need to not do so much. You know, and at Ring of Honor, it was like, they gave him the ring. They gave him permission to do whatever he wanted to do. He was doing dives off of ladders and stuff with Michael Shane. And, you know, he was stealing the shows and whatever. And he did a match with Brian Danielson. And Brian basically told him, we're just going to wrestle. And Paul was like, well, what about if I do? And Brian was like, no, we're just going to wrestle. And that happened to be one of Paul's better matches at Ring of Honor. I'm not exactly sure what happened with you know, why he got released or whatever. I never really asked about it. I had heard different stories and stuff. I mean, how are you going to ask a guy, hey, why'd you get fired? You know, I never asked him those things. It's none of my business. Lance, because me and Lance Cade talked all the time, and Lance enjoyed working, him and Trevor enjoyed working with Paul and Brian. I mean, they had, you know, they did whatever, and there was no, Lance would tell me, there's some guys that I just don't want to mess with. You know, I'm scared to work with them because I'm going to get hurt. But with Paul and Brian, there was never that fear. I mean, they just went out there and did their thing. Paul's a little bit out there, but, I mean, that's just Paul. I love the death. He's a good guy. He does our shows in San Antonio with us, you know, with me and stuff. So, I mean, yeah, that's just, you know, that's just how he is.
Yeah. Hey, you just brought up Lance Cade. Sadly, unfortunately, Lance Cade was taken away from us way too soon. And sadly, that's a common occurrence in pro wrestling. What are your thoughts on Lance Cade?
And I'm not saying this in a bad way, but, I mean, just a waste of talent. I mean, Lance had, he had the wrestling world at his feet just about. I mean, he was getting ready to go into a program with Chris Jericho and Shawn, I believe, and Triple H on Raw. And, I mean, they were grooming him to be, like, you know, one of the main guys. Addiction's a tough thing to deal with. You know, it's... like you said, unfortunately, it's part of this business. But I think, you know, if you recognize it, you need to say something, you know. And with Lance, I mean, Lance was he's a bright kid. I was very close with him. I know his dad. We traveled quite a bit when he was breaking in. There were some personal issues that he was dealing with also. I don't know. It's unfortunate. Everybody says, oh, it's unfortunate. It's so sad. Guys just need, you know, Lance always told me, you know, no, I'm not going to, they'll never have me, I don't take that stuff, you know, I only take it when I have to, or, you know, I'm watching what I'm doing, it's, you know, but it happens, you know, and I told him, it happens, Lance, you need to, you know, if you ever need to talk, you know, just call me, if you need to, he would come by the gym and just work out with the guys, like, you know, and the guys are like, oh my God, Lance Cade, what do you tell him? Tell him what's up. I don't know, I mean, he's, you know, Lance never gave my students, my current students at the time or whatever, you know, don't hit me too hard. I'm a WWE guy. You know, Lance just went out there and he was a student again, and he enjoyed being in the ring with us. As like you said, it just brought him back memories of when he was training and there was no pressure. It was just go out there and have fun. You know, and when I heard what happened, I mean, it was just. You know, you can scream and holler and say why, and you know, but that's not going to do any good. It's just unfortunate. You know, it's unfortunate.
Yeah.
Another kid named Cameron Bates, same thing. Same situation. Now Cameron, I was angry. I was pissed. I can't even. I can't even explain how angry I was because we had those discussions. And same thing with Lance. It was like, I'm never having to be, there's nothing wrong with me. And I'm like, dude, you're looking at him and his eyes are, you know, excited and fast open stuff. And I feel like, and I may get heat for this, I don't really care. I mean, it's how I feel. I feel like there were people in his life that could have made a difference. Me and Cameron weren't close. We weren't, you know, he came to the gym and trained with us, but it, you know, there are other people in his life, in his life that I'm sure if they would have sat him down and just gave him a third degree, they could have made a difference. I don't know. All I know is I put my foot down and said, look, guy, I love you to death, Cam. You're a good guy. I want you to continue training, but you cannot be here if you're going to be, you know, on pills. And you're like, well, I'm all right. So no, you're not all right. You know, and I just told him, we need to get help. You know, a couple of months later, a month later, so he was same thing. Someone called. As a matter of fact, I was messing around with my Facebook and I saw someone put, you know, rest in peace, Cameron Bates. And I'm like, what the hell? And then somebody else on their timeline or whatever put down, you know, he was a great guy. I loved working with him. I hope he's found peace in his life. You know, rest in peace, Spiro. And I'm like, Jesus Christ. And, you know, it's not a good feeling.
Yeah. Yeah, it's at the very least now, you know, the WWE, they're very strict on their medicals. Like, they just told Hulk Hogan that he can't do anything physical, and then they're more than happy to pay for anybody's rehab if they work for the company. So at least there's some changing, and hopefully there'll be less deaths. I do have a couple more things I want to get to. I know you've been on the phone for quite a while, but could you just talk about your time with Ring of Honor?
Sure. Let's see. Ring of Honor was, at the time, there was, my thing is, with modern, you know, modern day wrestler, I guess you could say, is, and that's, you know, the now time, from 2000 to now, I guess, the older guys, and I may get heat for this, I don't know, the older guys, their time has come and gone already. Scott Steiner, Kevin Nash, Sting. I mean, they've got their place in this business. I mean, I'm not taking anything away from those guys. They went to a place I'll never be at, and I'm happy for those guys. But when they're part of a company and their action, I guess, their position with the company is holding down fresher, newer faces. When you're holding those guys down, then you're not really helping the company, and you're not helping the business. And so WCW, I feel like part of the reason why they went the way they did was because the older guys were on top all the time. And I remember looking at ratings, and you can actually break the ratings down. And the highest part of the show was when Chris Jericho and Dean Malenko and Juventud and the, you know, the Luchador guys were on TV. And all those guys were fresh faces. They were all new faces and stuff. The common sense would tell me, you know, if these guys are bringing Brady, we need to push them a little bit. Yes, wrestling's always been a big man's business, but, you know, if the fans are turning the TV on to watch these guys and then turning the TV off, change the channel, when these other guys come on, you need to spread out these guys that are drawn throughout the show so that that fan at home can watch that TV show longer. So there was a guy that ran a promotion up in Philadelphia. He tried to run a promotion, and he had a bunch of the older guys that were released from WCW on this card, and he called me if I can get in contact with a couple of guys, and I was like, won't you try putting in Brian Kendrick? Won't you try using Matt Bentley? Won't you? And he's like, no one knows who they are. A story I heard was that Paul Heyman was actually looking at building ECW around Matt Bentley before he shut down. So this guy was like, you know, no one knows who they are. No one, you know, I didn't need to go. I need to get a hold of whoever. I'm like, I don't have their name. So that promotion, I think, ended up I don't even think he did a show. I think he may have done the show, but the guy may have walked out. I don't know. But then I started reading up where Rob Feinstein and Gabe Sapolsky, who I didn't know at the time, and Doug Gentry were looking at starting a promotion up in Philadelphia. And when Sean was doing his shows down here, Doug and Rob were coming down with their cameras and recording the matches. And that's how I got to meet him. So I pulled up Rob's number, and I'm like, hey, Rob, I've got some guys, you know, and, you know, not asking for, you know, any money or anything like that, just give them an opportunity. And he was like, well, do you have this guy's number? Do you have Brian Kendrick's number? I said, yeah, I got Brian's number. Well, yeah, we can do this and we can do that. If you guys can show up here, then, yeah, let's see what we can do. And so Rob, Doug, and Gabe started Ring of Honor, and I brought up a van. It was a 7-seater van. We had 9 guys, and we drove from San Antonio to Philadelphia. Brian Danielson, they already had his number. They flew him in. Brian Kendrick was living in Louisville, I believe, and we picked him up along the way and brought him in. And Matt Bentley was in Kentucky somewhere, Nashville, I think, and we picked him up and brought him with us. And so, like the first Ring of Honor show, they had Mikaika Loa and Oz, the guy that we trained at Sean's place. I guess 200 guys, can't remember who they were. Masada was with us. Don Juan and Chris Marvel was with us. And then there was Matt Bentley, and then Michael Schoen, what's his name? Brian Danielson and Brian Kendrick. And you know, when they had the second show, we brought the same crew, you know, 7-seater van. And 9 guys, and they, you know, Gabe saw and Rob saw that we were driving up there. We weren't asking for any money. We weren't asking. All we were looking for was an opportunity. And so they started giving the guys little spots. Down here, wrestling was, I'm not going to say it was bad. It was just stale. I mean, Paul was like this star head to shoulders above a lot of guys down here. There are a few guys that were doing well also, but not a whole lot. When we went up to Philadelphia, I mean, it was just a whole atmosphere. Just, you know, the fans are involved chants going on. The SATs are, I've never met those guys before. I read about AJ Styles, good kid. I finally met this guy, Chris Daniels, all those guys. Amazing Red. I mean, you know, the first Bonner did was at Eddie Guerrero versus Super Crazy. Just a completely different atmosphere, completely different attitude. To Gabe and Doug said, as long as you guys come up here, we'll find a spot for you. And so that's how, I mean, I was proud to be part of that company. It was great to be a group. It was like catching lightning in a bottle, I guess. It was, everything was just clicking.
Yeah, they had a great, they got TV. I think aren't they in town next week? Oh, it looks like we lost Rudy. He dropped off. Maybe he'll call back. So I guess I'll try and keep talking for a little while. not really sure what to say. Anyway, next week, it looks like we will have another guest, and that is, we will be having, hopefully, I just got to make sure that if he can do it for sure, he said he would, but next week it looks like we will be joined by Bobby Fulton of the Fantastics, and that should also be a good interview. Let me face back Rudy and see if he's going to call back. Of course, my thing didn't say. We lost you. Would you like to... He just Facebooked me better. We got cut off.
Let me tell him to call back. Okay, yeah, so Bobby Fulton, the Fantastics, hopefully next week, one of the best tag teams of all time. And like Nate Couture said, we consider them to be better than the Rock and Roll Express. And I probably almost put them as the second best babyface tag team, only behind Ricky Steamboat and Jay Youngblood. And other than that, I mean, one of the top babyface tag teams of all time. And so hopefully that'll be a good show. And hopefully our co-hosts will both be back next week. And also, congratulations to Craig for getting a spot on the Brian Avini show. And he will be a biweekly co-host of that show coming up. I think maybe his first show will be this coming week. And Rudy is calling back, so it'll just be a minute here. And we'll finish up. I do have a few more things I want to talk to. He's been a great guest so far. And, yeah, congratulations to Craig. Hopefully, now that he is officially a part of the show, Brian will allow him to plug the show. You know, Brian has this thing about not wanting to plug our show for some reason. Maybe it has to do with that. I give him hell all the time. But hopefully now we have an insider in the website, so hopefully it'll lead to bigger and better things for Over the Top Radio as a whole. So, you know, good congratulations to Craig on that. And hopefully Couture will be feeling better next week. It took me a long time to get over my cat dying. And, oh, you know what? Rudy might not be able to call since we're off the thing. He told me that it's not letting him call in. So I'm going to go ahead and end the show here in a second. And maybe we can get him on at a future time, and we will talk a little bit more. So everyone, come back next week, and we will talk to you then. Thank you very much.